Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this morning. It is a delight to have you with us. Each day we start off with an open discussion of issues in the news and beyond. And today we have, as we always do, a very distinguished group of people. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. Always nice to see you. It must be cold up there in Greenwich.
It's cold everywhere, I think. Judy Patrick, of course, hailing from Greenwich as well, and I was it was cold, sure.
It's cold all over this
morning. Yeah, it's just a cold day.
I didn't mean to offend either of you necessarily. It's just that it's further north. I thought it might be colder up there.
I didn't mean to offend you, but if I did, well, then that's an added bonus.
Yes. Well, then you, or as Mel Brooks once said, you found me out.
Judy Patrick is the Daily Gazette editor and joins us this morning. Ray Graff is with us for a bit this morning, our intrepid newsman.
Holding the fort for about 15 minutes.
That's right. And then Jimmy Vielkind will be here at 9:30.
Yes.
Of course, the Capital New York reporter.
That's what they call him.
And bureau chief something. And he will be with us, and we'll get a State of the State preview with him coming up in just, as Ray said, about 15 minutes.
Right.
After the NPR news break. So here are some stories that we want to talk about before we talk New York State and other states, as all the states start to roll out their State of the State agenda. Let us begin with sort of the gossip, which is making news this morning, and that is former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has written a book. He is strongly criticizing President Barack Obama's handling of the war in Afghanistan. The name of the book, In Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary of War. Mr. Gates says that the president was skeptical that his administration's Afghan strategy would succeed. Mr. Gates writes, I never doubted his support for the troops, only his support for their mission. He was the first Pentagon head to serve presidents of different parties before leaving political office in 2011. And although he describes Mr. Obama as a man of personal integrity, quote, who was right in his decisions regarding Afghanistan, he says that the president was uncomfortable with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which he inherited from the Bush administration. He also says Mr. Obama was distrustful of the military that was providing him options. So I think there's two ways that you can, well, I guess there's many ways that you can read this. One of them is that that doesn't seem like a bad description, actually, of the president, does
no,
it?
No. And I would agree with that. I would say shame on him. As far as I heard, when I read that, I said, well, that's great. I had grave reservations about Afghanistan
and Iraq
also. And I thought that the president's strategy of getting out was exactly right. I think the American people think it's right. But, hey, you got to sell them books. And
gossip, though. I mean, you mentioned it as gossip. I mean, this guy was there, right? Gates
I meant the fact that he's telling the tale in the book and telling stories of his time in the administration. Right. That's all.
Remember, he was a Republican appointee who got who was there and who Obama wanted to show that he was balanced, that he kept him on, and he agreed
and
to
continuity,
serve.
Right?
Yeah. So there's a little kiss and tell here. Which I don't think is that nice of Gates. I always had a better impression of Gates than this. You know, you can just sort of see the publisher sitting around the table with him and say, okay, how are we going to sell these books? What are you going to say that's a little different? And this is what it is.
Yeah, I remember when these kiss and tells first started to come out, and I'm still not used to them after all these years. You think, wow, isn't loyalty out there anywhere anymore? But I think the public's interest is served when we get to know a little bit about these behind-the-scenes discussions.
Well, and to your point, it always was. The kiss and tells go back. I mean, that's you know, forever. But the new thing, the new wrinkle is to do it when somebody is still in office and there's an administration and dealing with the same issues that we're still dealing with Afghanistan.
Or when somebody is either dead or not dead. I mean, you know, this Rockwell thing, which you've had such a hand in interviewing everybody, Joe, you know, saying all kinds of stupid things, you know, after the man is deceased and start talking about being a pedophile with not a single whit of evidence about it, you know, because he had pictures, he drew a Saturday Evening Post pictures of kids. I mean, give me a break. That was terrible. And so we who read this stuff and I see you have two books up here which look very well read. We have to read it. We have to make up our own assessments, right? I mean, I happen to think your point was very well taken, that the Gates book makes me more confirmed that Obama knew what he was doing.
Well, you took a shot at a lot of people.
Boy, he sure did. All-encompassing. What shot? That was artful.
What shot?
I'm going to digest all that and then we'll come back.
Wow.
You know, but I didn't think the Gates, what I read of the Gates book wasn't particularly damning of Obama. I expected a lot of the things he said to be true. That's what I expected. I didn't think he was saying Obama was devious. I think he believes he's an honorable president. He just was reluctant about this war, even though he didn't increase the troop strength in Afghanistan.
Yeah, there's a
real danger in jumping to conclusions about this, because there have been a few blurbs out there that we've seen in the press, and Joe will have read it by tonight. But nobody else will have read it right away. So,
well, you know, the other thing, too, is that I'm always surprised about is you read these things where they say, oh, you know, this is the blurb from the book and this is the whole tenor. And then you pick up the book thinking that that is going to be what it's about, and it's going to just be a hatchet
job
of Gates going after Obama. And then when you read it, it's one line. You know, maybe it's one line. And that becomes the big issue.
And the press goes into a feeding frenzy about it.
Right, and we're falling into that trap. We don't know.
No, we're not. But that's why
I use the word gossip.
You know, but somebody is going to. We've all been there. Judy's been there. I've been there. You're around. Senior Cuomo gives a press conference. There's one line in it. The guys are pouring over the thing. There it is, you know, and so everybody jumps on it. There's a feeding frenzy. The press goes crazy with it because they know that that's what will interest most people.
So hats off to you guys for offering some context on this story.
Well, thank you very much, Judy. I appreciate that for your input and help. Obviously, this is a story, as I mentioned, this is a story that goes on. We're still dealing very much with Afghanistan. And I think, to your point, Judy, this also, to look at the good side of this, is this does give us some context as to where we've been and perhaps to help us fill in the blanks, get one perspective as to where we should go. I mean, that's the good way of looking at this, I think, right? All right, Alan's asleep. All right.
No, he's not asleep.
No, I'm not asleep. I just thought maybe I talked too much, so now.
Yeah, well, you had your head down.
Yeah, because he pulled his hat down over his eyes and bid me a fair adieu.
Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Pure Catskills, supporting local farm, food, and wood businesses, clean water, and working landscapes throughout the Catskills region. PureCatskills.com. SUNY Ulster Continuing and Professional Education, Kingston. An open house with Melanie Young, breast cancer survivor and author of Getting Things Off My Chest, Thursday, January 16th from 4 to 7 p.m. SUNYUlster.edu for schedule. And 10,000 Villages in Stuyvesant Plaza, Albany, and on Main Street in Northampton. Featuring fairly traded home decor and gifts handcrafted by artisans around the world. 10,000villages.com.
Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. It is 20 minutes after 9. You only got 10 minutes left, right?
9 minutes to go, baby.
Hey, Joe, you started it, but I started it? Okay, I started it. But Joe's got these two books here that he's going to interview the authors on today.
Yes.
And Joe has a terrific reputation,
sure,
and it's true, of having read all the books, unlike most of us who sometimes, you know, say, and so why did you write this book?
Right.
You know, you're off to the races. So these books look really
solid. Well, they're
solid,
in pristine condition.
Pristine condition. So I said, you know, before, just a little joke between Joe and I, it looks very well read. Joe took a little bit of offense at that. And now Joe just said to me, you know, I have them here, it's true, but I have them on my Kindle, and that's where I read them.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I owe you a public and heartfelt apology for having teased you.
Often the publishers will send you advanced copies digitally, and I'll put those in my iPad, and I will look through those.
And not for sale, printed on the back of the ones they send you, the real ones. Not for sale.
Whatever.
You know, I often wonder whether the worst Christmas present in the world to get Joe Donahue is a book.
Oh, yeah.
I got a lot of them, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. But, you know, the great thing is that, we're going to have Jane Isay on, and I love her, and this book is amazing, so we'll talk to her about that. And then we'll also talk about organization and creative discipline.
I say this is a great idea.
Okay. Let us go to other topics, and... Alan, or Reyes, is just a watch in his hand, ready to go.
7.5 minutes to go.
Yes, very good. Let us talk about the Senate working on unemployment benefits. It seemed yesterday we were talking about this issue, where would the Senate go on this? And the Senate's unexpected vote on Tuesday to advance legislation extending expired unemployment benefits touched off delicate negotiations to secure final passage in the chamber, even as Republicans and Democrats warily eyed the political motives behind the efforts. So what are the political motives,
Alan? The political motives are that everybody who's on unemployment in the country, if you don't do anything, is going to hate your guts and hold you responsible. And if you happen to be in a close senatorial race of any kind, surprise that the two people who sponsored the bill are from the two states with the greatest unemployment going on. So I think that's some of the political motives. The other thing is that the Democrats are unashamed about saying we're going to use this as a tentpole in the congressional elections that are coming up right now, because it just shows once again that the few people at the very top don't care about all those people at the bottom.
And as usual, we're talking about an issue, and we just can't talk about the issue. We have to talk about the politics of it. And we have to tie it to extraneous issues unrelated to it in terms of getting something done, compromises, bringing totally unrelated issues.
But, Judy, you know how much respect and love I have for you. But don't
watch
you,
it. Watch it. Know. Watch it. Here it comes.
The shield's coming up here.
But don't you think that's the way the game is played?
Sadly, that is the way the game is played. I'm arguing that... can't we just discuss this issue, whether or not we should extend unemployment benefits for another 3 months, how long people should be on unemployment, what we should be doing to get people jobs so we don't have to continue with this?
But proof positive is that now you get the Senate making this intelligent decision, I think, and now it's got to go to the House. And the House, it's purely political. They say, okay, but then we want Obamacare stripped, and we want this, and we want that as a result of this. And it has very little to do with public policy.
And let us not forget, yesterday, our senior senator, Chuck Schumer, said these words, and I don't think this was hyperbole at all. He said the vote was a shift in the tectonic plates of our politics.
Wow. You said that?
Now that says a lot.
Yeah. Almost the tectonic plates.
I didn't feel anything at all.
No. Tectonic.
That's what he said. Well, what he meant was
politics.
What he meant was that a lot of Republicans went along with it.
Yeah.
And that this is a shift. We're seeing more and more of this in the United States Senate. You know, Chuck Schumer is an incredible politician. He really is. He came here one day and he announced, and he brought with him a Subway thing from next door.
A Subway sandwich.
Yeah, Subway.
Bread,
thing.
Meat,
yeah.
Some veggies.
And it's a sandwich he invented called a Schumwich. And wherever he goes in New York State, he sends his staff out and they get him, bring him back a Schumwich from the Subway.
What is it?
No, what would be great is if we know what was
in
it.
Yeah, I forget.
Yeah, okay, all right.
David Gustina knows this stuff.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, we have 4 minutes to go, Ray. Now, let us talk about Hillary Clinton. A super PAC backing Hillary Clinton says it has raised $4 million in 2013. Ready for Hillary, a super PAC that is urging Hillary Rodham Clinton to run for president in 2016, announced Tuesday that it raised more than $4 million last year, thanks to the groundswell of enthusiasm for Hillary's potential run and the steadfast commitment of our supporters. We have exceeded our goals and are ahead of schedule in raising the funds necessary to build a grassroots army that can be activated the moment Hillary makes a decision, according to the executive director of the group. So, is that a lot of money?
No. When you think that Andrew, Prince Andrew, has
Cuomo, the governor of
New York City, has 30 million last look in his, and that he was charging $50,000 a seat for that Billy Joel concert for the top tier of people who were buying it. 30 million is a lot more in advance than 4 million is, and one's for governor and one's for the whole country. But on the other hand, I'm fascinated by these super PACs and what their responsibilities are. The real question is, does Hillary control them? Are you following? That is a big issue, because I think there is supposed to be some limited communication, isn't there? Or am I getting this all mixed up?
And the other issue is, how many of these little PACs are out there raising $4 million?
And are they competing with each other?
The Ready for Hillary, their staff does include some former campaign workers from Hillary Clinton's 2008 effort. And is focused on collecting voter data, building a list of potential supporters, and doing voter organizations work in the state. In 2013, the group said it garnered the support of 1.5 million supporters on Facebook. But again, grassroots, meaning that it is not official. It is an offshoot that is going out on its own to get this money and support.
But grassroots, they said, limiting campaign contributions to $25,000, which is a ton of money. But the article also goes on to say that 98% of these contributions are $100 or less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is pretty impressive when you think about it.
Yeah.
The Republican National Committee and at least one Republican super PAC are treating her as a Democratic nominee. This article says on Tuesday, Republicans highlighted the Robert Gates book to question Clinton's motivation for opposing the 2007 troop surge in Iraq. So what the games begin, and we come full circle in this discussion. Ray, we have 1 minute. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with in your final moments here?
I feel a great tectonic shift in the program coming.
Or as we say here, a great tectonic shift.
Right. Get it. And that'll be Jimmy in a moment.
Yeah. We'll go that. We will go with that in just a moment. Also, we're going to hear the latest from NPR News. Then we will get a State of the State preview and talk about many other issues as well. We welcome your comments. As always, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll continue after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick joins us. And Capital New York Bureau Chief Jimmy Vielkind is with us now. And good morning, all. Thank you very much.
Hey. Good morning.
Jimmy, let us go to you first. It is it's the big day in the state capitol, the State of the State address. You know, heck of an opening act. You have the vice president in yesterday. Monday was marijuana. Tuesday was the vice president, and today is the actual
That's right.
Address.
Actually, marijuana kind of landed on Sunday.
Yeah, that's right.
Unlike earlier years, the Cuomo administration has sort of parceled out some of the major initiatives of this speech. Governor Cuomo's fourth State of the State address and his election year State of the State address in various newspapers around the state. And so one of the big things to come out ahead was that the governor intends to take a law that has been on the books since 1980 and essentially allow kind of a pilot program for medicinal marijuana at 20 hospitals around the state. And this maneuver comes at a time when two things are happening. One, advocates of loosening the state's marijuana laws, either by allowing broad medical usage, or there's even a bill to just legalize small amounts of marijuana, have started to pick up a little bit of traction, and some money and some lobbying efforts are coming behind it. So I think this is Cuomo's way to keep things a little bit more moderated. And it's also a nod to progressives on the left who are pushing him on a number of fronts, this being one of them. And those progressives are, of course, emboldened by the election in November of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. But I expect the thrust of the speech is going to be economic. The governor on Monday unveiled a tax plan, $2 billion parceled out over 3 years with various elements, a reduction in corporate taxes, an accelerated phase out of an energy surcharge, the so-called 18A surcharge, and for homeowners, sort of a two-tiered approach. First, what's being called a property tax freeze, where if a municipality abides by the state's 2% property tax cap, homeowners will be given a rebate so that they're essentially held harmless with their taxes. And then second, a program that has long been advocated by people on the left, what's called a circuit breaker, where a homeowner would receive a rebate on their property taxes if those taxes exceed a portion of their income. So this is really aimed at what they say are people, quote unquote, trapped in their own homes, perhaps a pensioner or someone on Social Security who still owns a house, is still placing a property tax bill that, you know, as sure as I was going to make a Red Sox joke, but I guess the Red Sox win the World Series now. As sure as the Phillies not winning the World Series, you know, will go up every single year.
But your
income does not go up. So that kind of element there.
But if the so-called circuit breaker, but if you're living in Long Island at a little box and you're paying $20,000 in taxes on that thing, this is a very powerful argument for Cuomo to be making, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I talked to a man named Bruce Jory, who's a political advisor, consultant, and a professor here at UAlbany, who said, there's a lot of pressure for Cuomo to tack left and to look to the left. Mm. And if you look at his 2013 State of the State Address, that is last year's State of the State Address, that's arguably what he did. Strong stances on abortion, strong stance on gun control, which resulted in the New York State SAFE Act, talk and a push for the minimum wage increase. And a lot of people said that was happening because of a nascent 2016 presidential ambition. Were he to do so, he'd want to stake out a left flank position that would protect him if he ever needed to enter a Democratic primary. I think that's far more subordinate this year. I think that the eye is toward a statewide reelection campaign coming in November.
Sure.
And as Jory noted, 70% of the electorate in the last gubernatorial election came from outside of New York City. So Cuomo knows that he's aiming at a more moderate audience, and I believe he's going to tailor his message accordingly while doing enough to sort of keep the progressive wing of the party.
The de Blasio wing. Now, let me talk to you about that, because I think it's a great thing that you really ought to help us with. De Blasio clearly made centerpiece, which is pre-K.
Mm-hmm.
Give everybody in the state or give everybody in the city, Cuomo's going to come back, and I knew he would. And I said, so he's going to give pre-K. So he goes back and says, we'll figure out a way to give your pre-K. De Blasio, but no tax hikes. But de Blasio comes back and says, absolutely tax hikes. So he's really waving that red flag right in front of on millionaires. He's waving that red flag right in Cuomo's face.
Yeah. And it's interesting that at the same time that the governor on Monday was talking about his proposed package of tax cuts, de Blasio down in New York City was flanked by labor leaders talking about this pre-K push and talking about what for him is at this point inextricably linked, the proposal to raise income taxes on New York City residents reporting more than $500,000 worth of income. And so, you know, we everything that we are hearing is that Governor Cuomo wants to find a way to pay for this. And we'll see. I think he may address in some form his plans for pre-K today, but certainly in the coming weeks we're going to hear what he hopes to do, whether it's going to be a statewide program, whether it's going to be an expanded pilot program, which the pilot project, one of them will be in New York City. So we're expecting to hear more details on that. Of course, Cuomo would like to do this without raising taxes for his own political needs. But if he wants to box in de Blasio, the best way to do so, and I'm not saying he does, the best way to do so would be to come out and say, here we can fund pre-K. Here we are helping the children. You guys just want to raise taxes.
Yeah.
You know, essentially splitting the argument in half.
Well, but the point really is that people don't really care about taxing millionaires. Raising taxes on millionaires. They care about raising taxes on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
that's always worked. So it's an attractive de Blasio position, seems to me.
Well, and its advocates point out two things. They say, you know, in the state of New York, we have an old governmental structure. We're constitutionally a local government, be it the city of New York, be it Schenectady County, Saratoga County, can't raise taxes without the approval of the state legislature. Right. And the roots of this date back to the days when, you know, you had these Tammany Hall Democrats in New York City, and you had an upstate kind of Republican establishment not wanting these crazy, you know, these crazy immigrant Democrats doing crazy things. So they set up, they essentially stacked the deck so that they couldn't raise taxes and kind of be left to their own devices. And we're still living with that legacy. So the argument that you hear from proponents of this tax hike is that it's just local control, right? So last year, Rensselaer County, Albany County, I don't know if Schenectady County, renewed its sales tax. Every few years, these counties have to renew their sales tax, right? We all pay 8%, right, unless in Saratoga County,
in fact,
where we
a big
pay
fight
7%.
Down in, big fight down in Ulster County about that very issue.
Very big fight about this issue, right? And so in most places, it's done as a matter of course. And even Republicans, even the staunchest anti-government spending Republicans say, we're acquiescing to this is what the county legislature wants. We're submitting this bill. Mm-hmm. Usually they're nearly unanimously approving for these to renew these things or even to increase sales taxes in some instances. Why is it different here? If New York City says through the city council and through its mayor, hey, Albany, we want to raise taxes to pay for this pre-K program, why shouldn't the same deference be given? And that's the
argument. Jimmy, isn't there a difference, though, between sales taxes and income tax, which New York City has?
In what way?
Well, how many people have, does Albany have an income tax on top of a sales tax? That's the point. New York City has an onerous income tax.
Well, New York City does have an income tax. Yonkers has its own income tax.
Yep.
But I think that the argument is sort of separated from the economics of it and more into the idea of the local control.
No, I hear you. I hear you. It's a good point.
And then the other argument that they make is, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, a fairly prominent and powerful Democrat from New York City, from Lower Manhattan, said, you know, look, David Dinkins, the former mayor of New York City, who came before Rudy Giuliani but after Ed Koch, recognized, as Mr. Silver told it, said, he went to the business community and he said, we have a crime problem and I want to little bit more money. I want to raise some money. It's going to be through a real estate tax. We're going to use that to hire more cops. And they did it. And okay, more cops. And now New York City's crime problem is not a scintilla of what it was during that era. And all the people who paid that higher taxes have seen their properties rise. The businesses have prospered. It was literally a public investment. Will de Blasio be able to make that same case? Will he be able to say, look, you people are the people who will pay this tax? If we do this, we're going to invest in our children. We're going to have lower rates of social delinquency. We're going to have better prepared students because all the educational research shows that students have better long-term outcomes with this pre-K, three-year-old, four-year-old support.
Cutting to the politics, what happens in the state Senate,
right,
where you have those four errant, that's my word, Democrats.
Good, it's a good word.
Who have come over the line to help support the Republicans and keep them in power. What are they, since they're more Democrats, you know, and some of these people these errant Democrats are facing primaries. What's going to happen to them if the Senate is the one who gets on their hind legs and says no to pre-K?
Well, that's one of the things that we're going to be watching this year. I think that we have to first watch Governor Cuomo, watch what his position and his posture is going to be, and then we will see the Senate react to that. Now, in the preliminary stages, we're seeing that four-member Senate Independent Democratic Conference staunchly in support of Mr. de Blasio and of the pre-K tax, because as you know, they are mindful of challenges on their left flank.
Sure, but what happens if in fact Skelos, who was supposed to share power with those four Democrats, as you remember, says nothing doing, we're not bringing this up?
Then I think it puts a question and it begins a blame game, kind of the jury of which will be the electorate this year. You know, last year, a lot of the progressive left, which is mostly union groups and some progressive organizing groups like Citizen Action, they placed their ire on the IDC, that four renegade group. And they said, you had promised to bring this agenda to the floor, and lo and behold, it did not come to the floor. The question is whether that ire will be similarly directed this year if there is no action. But I think that if you have the alignment of Andrew Cuomo the IDC, the Democrats who dominate the assembly, it will be a much harder road for Senator Skelos and the Republicans in that chamber to say no. Whereas if you just have the assembly, the IDC, and not a firm, strong backing by Cuomo, you know, I don't think that the Senate Republicans will be so compliant. What we learned last year was essentially this, and what we've seen in the last 3 years is essentially this. The independent Democrats have not been able to bring a bill to the floor without the acquiescence of their Republican coalition governing partners. Mm. But we have seen Senate Republicans willing to bring legislation to the floor, even when it's not something that's supported by the majority of their own conference, when Governor Cuomo has been pushing them. So I think that's telling, and it's that equation that will inform or allow us to predict what's going to happen this year.
Well, there are some people who say, Jimmy Vielkind, that the problem is that Cuomo likes to have the issue, but doesn't necessarily want to win. In other words, the issue is more important. He raises a women's agenda in his last speech, and everybody says, yeah, that's good, but that hasn't happened yet. How much, as you just indicate, how much does he really want it?
Well, can we answer that? We have to take a break because we're late and we don't want people mad at us.
No.
So let's do that and we'll come back and then you can answer. So it gives you time to more, even more articulately. Not that you.
Not possible.
Similarly.
Yes. It'll be great. We'll be right back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York. Locally owned and operated since 1988. Open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com. And St. Bernard's School of Theology and Ministry, Albany. A graduate school of theology offering 3 master's degrees and courses for audit. Classes 4 nights a week. StBernard's.edu. And Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady. Featuring new dental technology, including implants and computer-aided local anesthesia. PaduladDDS.com.
When we last left, Alan had asked Jimmy a question. The question being, Alan,
who remembers?
Well, I think you were asking about the IDC, and you're asking about whether or not Governor Cuomo would prefer to have these as electoral issues,
yes.
Particularly the abortion issue.
Sure.
I don't necessarily think so. I think that what we've seen from the governor in the past 3 years is that fundamental to his political narrative and fundamental to his modus operandi is that he wants government to function. For so long, and stretching back for years, longer than I've been observing the Capitol, and so I defer both to you, Judy, and to you, Alan, to back me up on this, the basic narrative of Albany was they disagreed, nothing got done, somehow taxpayers had to pay and got stuck with the bill or their lives were otherwise not improved because of it, right? And the Cuomo narrative has been, we got something done. They talked about the redistricting process, how bad it was for years. We got something done. They talked about legalizing gay marriage
really
for years.
They really
we got
did.
Something. Well, yeah. And that's the thing, right? Because the devil and the whether or not you are happy with it lies in the details. But Cuomo has always valued accomplishment, moving on as a narrative, and can credibly, on lots and lots of issues, go to the voters in November and say, hey, they blasted my tax plan. Tell me, are your taxes lower than they were? And in my bracket, I'll say, yes, they are. You have lowered my taxes. You'll say, you're welcome.
Is that why he took that approach to medical marijuana in executive order rather than trying to get it done through the legislature?
I think that it's not quite an executive order. There was a law that was passed in 1980. So the legislature
has
acted.
Well, but there are regs. So what he's doing is filling in the regs because there was
blanks.
A law. But Judy's point is, it basically is the governor and an executive decision to do that.
This is the way it's going to be.
Right. Yeah. So again, people for years said New York should have medicinal marijuana. These people are suffering. They need compassion. They need this option of a drug. And it will theoretically get done. So yes, it's along that same vein, though I think there are a few other reasons why he took that approach. So Alan, I don't think he seeks the electoral issue. I think that he would much rather have the deal.
I think it's up in the air, to be honest with you. I know the guy fairly well. I have great respect for his passion about politics. But I think, like his father, he's always thinking about what the right move in a particular case is and how to trap the other guys. I think his big dilemma right now is the New York State Senate, because I think he put them where they are. I truly do. I think that, you know, he said his number one priority when he ran for governor the first time was he wasn't going to allow them to draw their own shameful districts. He gave up on that, and he kept them where they were, in power. Along come these four Democrats. Did he yell at the four Democrats? Did he bring them into a room? Did he hit them over the head with a cane? No, not really. I think an argument could be made. He wanted it that way. So he had the big, bad Republicans who could say to the progressive Democrats, no, you can't have that.
Well, I think that he wants to be a centrist, and he makes no, you know, he makes no secret of that. I mean, if you look at his politics, you look at his platform, he is not in the classic sense sort of a liberal Democrat the way that Bill de Blasio is. Now, he's plenty progressive, and he's expressed that progressivism through social issues and through trying to make investments and helping the poor where he can. But he also is trying to be sort of Clintonian.
That's exactly
in the
right
way where he's trying to be mindful, respectful of the business community. Right. I mean, what was the group in the 90s that was this kind of third way for the Democratic Party? I'm blanking on the name of it.
Me too.
But he is of that ilk, and he is of that mindset. And de Blasio is not of that mindset.
But who's hotter right now? I say de Blasio is hotter right now, and that he's got to be very mindful of that, because if de Blasio leads his people in a different direction, this could be bad news for Cuomo.
It could, but I don't think that Bill de Blasio at this point is going to engage. Is he going to bring the troops to march on Albany?
Oh, Jimmy, I have a problem with that.
Well,
he's the guy who turned around de Blasio, as I just mentioned, and said, "Okay, we'll take the pre-K, but we're going to insist on the tax raise at the same time, even though you're promising us the pre-K and asking for the tax
We've heard nothing but praiseful words out of Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio's mouths each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be the case for the foreseeable
future.
Well,
then why did de Blasio stick the red flag in Cuomo's face on the tax issue of raising taxes?
Well, there's a difference, right? There's a difference between we have this disagreement on policy,
yeah,
and we're going to push, and we have this disagreement on policy, and I'm going to come at you with everything that I have. The troops are coming, the missiles are launched, the airstrikes are going. And so right now we have two political forces with a disagreement. We do not have outright conflict. And I think that both men have an incentive. They have a long personal relationship, and I think that they are both at least willing to make it a cold war rather than a hot war.
I'm
in a great place to wrap up or take a break.
Well, I want to launch one more missile here, but I do want to remind people that we're going to be covering the State of the State throughout the day. We'll of course have coverage during Midday Magazine coming up at noon today with Brian Shields, and we will have our previews, and then of course we will be covering the address at 1 o'clock. Alan will be hosting, and then we will continue post address discuss. Have your phone calls and welcome phone calls as part of an extended Vox Pop this afternoon. So we will be going most of the afternoon talking about many of these issues and many more that will come up in the State of the Joe. Do we know who the guests are? I don't have the paper in front of me. Okay, we have a great panel coming up, so it'll be fantastic, and we'll look forward to that. For the three of you, I guess, what should we, as for those of us who will be listening at home, what should we be? Is there something specific we should be listening for?
I'll be interested to hear. We've seen some leaks on some big things, but there is an expectation or a hope or a thought that the governor will talk about more details for casino siting, for how that process is going to go forward. I'll be listening for that. I'll be listening to see what he says about pre-K and about this issue, or what he doesn't say about it. I'll also be listening to see with what he says to an audience of legislators about this simmering issue of public corruption. Because on the one hand, Governor Cuomo needs to appear like he's doing something, and he needs to make a strong stance, but he doesn't want to be offensive about it. So that's going to be a tough line for him to walk, and I'll be curious to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, I'm interested in what he says about public corruption as well. Year after year, we hear about efforts to reform at the state legislature, and I think the public is really concerned about this. The other thing, when you listen to the state of the state, to keep in mind is this is just the beginning of the process. That in a few weeks, we'll get a copy of the state budget and what's being proposed to be actually spent. And really, the good discussion will happen in June when we figure out what actually happened after all this.
And I say what they said.
Much more coming up. And Alan will be leading the charge here at 1 o'clock this afternoon for the State of the State address that we'll be broadcasting live here on WAMC. Jimmy, Judy, and Alan, thank you very much.
My
appreciate
pleasure.
It. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.